From WAMU 88.5 at American University in Washington, welcome to the Politics Hour, starring Tom Sherwood. I'm Kojo Nam. Tom Sherwood is our resident analyst and a contributing writer at the Washington City Paper. Tom Sherwood, welcome.
Good afternoon, everyone.
Later in the broadcast, we will be speaking with Shebra Evans, who is the president of the Montgomery County Board of Education. Our first conversation, however, will be with Susan Swecker, who is chairwoman of the Democratic Party of Virginia. She joins us from studios at Virginia Public Media in Richmond. Susan Swecker, thank you for joining us.
Hello, I'm happy to be here with you all today.
First, Tom Sherwood, for the first time in history, a bill that would give statehood to the District of Columbia is now advancing beyond committee in the U.S. House of Representatives, and it looks like there will be a vote on the House floor. House Majority Leader Steny Hoyer saying that there would be a floor vote before the summer. It is historic, of course, but there will be cynics who will say, you know what's going to happen when this goes to the Senate, it's going to die.
Well, yes, but this, you know, trying to get statehood for the district is kind of like a centipede walking. There's a lot of steps. There was a vote in the House back in the early 90s that failed miserably, 277 to 153. But this is important because after many, many years of lobbying for this, virtually all the metropolitan area members of Congress and Senate are for this. Lots of national organizations have signed on. Eleanor Holmes Norton has made this her number one issue for her time in Congress. And the Democratic Party, once they got the took back the control
Nancy
of the House,
Pelosi said this was a priority for her.
Nancy Pelosi said so. And so, yes, it's moving. Yes, it's going to be voted on. Yes, it will probably pass the House. But yes, it will die in the Senate. Mitch McConnell, the Senate Majority Leader, has no interest in this. The Republicans all worry and know that two senators, Democratic senators, would be elected if there were statehood. There are a lot of other issues, but just one more shoe in the centipede towards statehood.
Susan Swecker, do you approve of statehood for the District of Columbia?
Absolutely, and I have signed petitions and think it's important that we move in that direction.
But one of the biggest issues was I asked people is, well, you know, if you're in the suburbs and the district were to become a state, there are hundreds of thousands of people who live in the suburbs that work in the city, you know, the district could impose a commuter tax. And I don't think the people in Virginia would necessarily like that, even though whatever the district charged, they could deduct it from their state income taxes in Annapolis and Richmond.
It has no longer apparently become a major obstacle for Democrats in Virginia who in past years had been reluctant to support statehood for the district for that reason. So,
well, I would say I am somewhat skeptical. I think some people support statehood for the district because they know it will never happen.
No,
I'm not saying that you,
speaking of cynicism.
Thank you.
Speaking of the other hot rumor, and of course the D.C. statehood bill advancing was not a rumor, but the hot rumor is based on phone calls that people have been receiving. WMU's Martin Ostermuhl reporting today that District of Columbia residents have been receiving phone calls from some kind of polling company with a New York area code number asking questions about whether or not they would approve of D.C. Mayor Muriel Bowser as a vice president running mate for former New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg. And Tom Sherwood, I'm sure you have a lot to say about this. You have already been on Twitter about it with other people. But where is this coming from?
Well, first of all, any legitimate polling firm would identify itself. It would say, we are the XYZ polling firm. We're doing a survey on whatever. And so there, and I don't know how many people have gotten this call. I just have to say that the concept that Mayor Muriel Bowser would be Mike Bloomberg's running mate is just not politically viable for many reasons. One, the district has three electoral votes. Now, Mayor Bowser has more experience as mayor than Mayor Pete Buttigieg does, but the district is not where you go to balance a ticket, and certainly Bloomberg, a New York mayor, would not come to the district to create a ticket. So I think I am just totally skeptical that this is any kind of legitimate poll.
And not only are you skeptical, but all of the people who have been seeing on Twitter, and Mayor Muriel Bowser has become mayor by an overwhelming majority of voters, but there don't seem to be any supporters of Mayor Muriel Bowser on your or anybody else's Twitter feed about this who are saying, yes, go ahead, I think she'd be great.
Well, it's just, you know, she's leaving today. She's en route to Houston to campaign for Mr. Bloomberg. So she's one of his national co-chairs. And, you know, Mayor Bowser's got her hands full. She could easily be appointed to some significant administration job if a Democratic president, Bloomberg, or anyone were looking for someone experienced in urban politics. But the idea that she would be the vice presidential candidate, I'd said on Twitter, I'm willing to take any legal bets people want to make. Now, because can we mention that, you know, Bloomberg is going to be speaking Richmond. It's a huge deal.
As a matter of fact, Mr. Bloomberg thinks Virginia can be very, very important to his presidential aspirations. And as Tom Sherwood just said, he will be speaking in Virginia. Our guest is Susan Swecker, who is chairwoman of the Democratic Party of Virginia. Have you yet endorsed anyone, Susan Swecker?
Yeah, let's see. I made a decision when we started this presidential process, this go-round, that I would not be endorsing. At a minimum, I'm not going to endorse until after Super Tuesday, and I'm not sure I will at that point. I think it's important for the party to be seen as you know, honest brokers and a place where you can come where any individual activist or campaign can come and get good answers from our professional staff and know that you know, we're gonna be upfront with you. Now, our situation is a little different. I mean, it's pretty straightforward. We have a state-run presidential primary on March the 3rd, so people go in and vote that day just like any other election day, and then the results of that will determine who gets how many delegates.
This Saturday night, what's the dinner called?
This is our third annual Blue Commonwealth Gala. We changed it from the old, little, tired, worn-out Jefferson Jackson Day dinner 3 years ago, and we actually moved up. We've been having it in the summer. But we did move it up this year to try to capitalize on the enthusiasm and excitement, but right before Super Tuesday.
And now Elizabeth Warren was in Virginia just yesterday. She was in Arlington at Wakefield High School. She got about 4,000 people there. But once you put out your notice that Mike Bloomberg had agreed to come, and I know it was open to any presidential candidate, mm-hmm. Democratic candidate, did ticket sales go up or down?
You know, I think
you're sold out, aren't you?
Yeah, we are sold out at this point. But I think there's a couple things. I think that the presidential announcing that was very helpful. But I also think there's a lot of excitement about, you know, the trifecta at the Virginia General Assembly. And people are just really excited and happy about what's going forward. We additionally have reached out to every presidential campaign and invited them. Some of them are in other states right now, but a lot of them are sending surrogates on their behalf.
Well, since we're on that topic, here's Jessica in Alexandria, Virginia. Jessica, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hi. My question is, do you think that Virginia will be a swing state in 2020?
Susan Swecker?
A lot of people want to say Virginia is a blue state, and I never want to say that. I think we are still a purple state, and Donald Trump has made it very clear that he wants to make an active play in Virginia this year. He didn't do that in 2016, that he wants to come in here and make a real effort in Virginia, and we are getting ready for that right now. And so I do think we're an important state. And we have had great success these last couple of cycles, but we're never going to let up on the gas.
On to the General Assembly. We are halfway through a 60-day session of the Virginia legislature that promises big changes for the Commonwealth on everything from gun control to women's rights. That's because for the first time in more than two decades, both the House and the Senate are controlled by Democrats. What's the atmosphere in Richmond right now, Susan Swecker? Are the Democrats really happy about this? Or Republicans feel that you're acting like a group of drunk sailors who now have the keys to the castle?
You know, you guys will remember this, and especially Tom, but I was around 20 years ago when the Democrats lost
control.
You were
around before that.
Tom okay, was now around before that.
Now you're going to reveal how old I really am, right?
For the listeners, and I first met Susan in the early 80s, so just when she was an aspiring political operative. But go ahead. You guys are living in, I think the South would say, you guys are living in high cotton.
Exactly. I mean, I just never thought I'd see the day that would come. We would get the trifecta, and we'd get it back. And when it happened pretty swift. And the best part about it for me, I think, and a lot of people, is actually the rich tapestry and diversity of these members of the General Assembly now, which when you have a legislature that looks more like the Commonwealth of Virginia, you have a more open and inclusive agenda that gets passed, and it is good for everybody. I mean, voting rights, expansion of voting rights, the ERA on the very first day, passing the ERA.
Why was that such a priority for you that you passed it on the very first day?
Well, I think there are a couple things. We wanted to send a signal that this was important. We'd almost gotten it passed last year. But also, we have a new Speaker of the House, the first female Jewish woman, Eileen Fillerkorn, a new majority leader.
From Fairfax.
And Charnel Herring from Alexandria. And then Senator Louise Lucas from Portsmouth, President Pro Tem, Senator Mamie Lott, majority leader of the Senate. I mean, and women, and African-American women are chairing committees. They're in leadership. And just watch them stand up there, gavel in, and pass the ERA was a monumentous occasion.
Now, some of the things people who drive and live in Virginia or go into Virginia appreciate some of the things you've done. The legislature has passed a ban on handheld cell phones. I think Virginia's been the last Wild West state where you could just drive with no hands if you had two phones. The ban on open containers of alcohol, tighter seatbelt restrictions. I remember Virginia even resisted requiring seatbelts until the federal government threatened to cut off transportation money decades ago. The changes in reckless driving. That's one thing. But also abortion. The Republicans who preceded you had put in restrictions on abortion requiring sonograms. There's just any number of things that have occurred, and the legislature's going to give local governments more power to tax. There's a lot of changes. You guys have made a lot of changes. Republicans are kind of steaming over it, but you would say you delivered on your campaign promises and the gun control, too.
Correct. I mean, this is you're exactly right. The voters said they wanted change, and we're delivering. Again, on gun control and also on climate change. They've passed the Clean Economy Act. That'll pave the way for 100% renewable energy. And we've joined RGGI now, something that the Republicans were opposed to.
RGGI.
RGGI, the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative.
Okay. Thank you
which, very much. Yeah, I'm sorry. But, you know, this is important stuff. And, you know, I'll talk a minute about the gun control. That's something that, you know, Governor Northam came out last summer and called into special session to address it after the Virginia Beach incident. And Republicans shut it down after 90 minutes and didn't even take up any of the bills, didn't allow any debate. And I think that had consequences on Election Day.
Well, now the House has passed all 8 measures that the governor has called for, including universal background checks and a purchase limit of 1 gun per month, but there seems to be some stalling, especially in the Senate, on an assault weapons ban. Apparently, the sponsor of the assault weapons bill in the Senate has withdrawn it from consideration, even though the House approved of it. What do you think is going to happen there?
Well, you know, we're still making a little sausage down here, and the House and Senate don't always agree on all their nuances, and they're going to have to get together and figure that out and come back. I certainly hope they can find something that would ban that. I mean, and look, I'm a rural girl. I grew up around guns. But, you know, guns, when I was growing up, were used for, you know, hunting and not for – I wouldn't grow up around assault weapons. In Highland County, the first day of hunting season was a day off. I mean, it was a holiday. It was a school holiday. But, you know, times change. And with all the issues we have with mental health and with guns getting in the wrong hands of people, the day of, you know, and I just make this point, the day of the gun rally down here, everybody says it was peaceful. Well, it was peaceful. I wouldn't say it was peaceful. We got out of there safe because of what Governor Northam and law enforcement did to keep us safe, and all the other groups stayed away. So the Virginia Defense League had it all to themselves. I walk out of the Y downtown, and there's a guy walking up the street with an assault rifle flopping around like a rag doll. It didn't make me feel very good.
Got to take a short break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation with Susan Swecker. She is chairwoman of the Democratic Party of Virginia. If you have questions or comments for her, give us a call at 800-433-8850. I'm Kojo Namdi.
This month at WAMU, we're lifting our voices to shine a light on Black changemakers throughout American history. Some you know and some you don't, but they all change the world. Go to WAMU.org/lifteveryvoice to learn the stories of these incredible African American changemakers and to hear special interviews spotlighting those who have impacted the arts, sciences, sports, and activism. Go to WAMU.org/lifteveryvoice.
Welcome back. Our guest is Susan Swecker. She is chairwoman of the Democratic Party of Virginia. Susan Swecker, the legislature's measures to restrict guns, loosen abortion restrictions, other votes to advance a progressive agenda have added to the feeling among conservatives that the state has been taken over by people who do not share their values. More specifically, expressing Republican frustrations, House Minority Leader Todd Gilbert this week warned that Democrats' willingness to raise taxes, boost labor, and mandate green energy would hurt businesses and Virginia's economy. How do you respond to that? Are Democrats in Virginia, in your view, unfriendly to business?
Well, the first thing I would like to say is we have been in the top of best state managed in the country by number one, two, or three under several Democratic, most Democratic governors. So we have strong strong leadership and a strong business climate. And one of the things that these are just things they throw out. I mean, I think Delegate Herring's speaker, Filler Corn, you know, had about enough mansplaining by Todd Gilbert, who just seems to not really understand that the voters of Virginia have spoken. But when you have the reason, like you have somebody like Amazon, for example, that wants to come to Virginia, what they want are things like a livable wage. They want to know that their employees are going to be protected. And that's why passing these the Virginia Values Act that bans discrimination in housing, employment, and a public accommodation on the basis of sexual and gender identity is so important. They want to know that Virginia is an open and welcoming state. And look, I get it. It's hard when you lose. I was there, and I watched that 20 years ago. But I got to tell you, I didn't see the Democratic leaders, being petulant and whining around like this group has.
Let me just talk about one thing you didn't do. The legislature did not change the right to work law in the state. That was one thing. Mm-hmm. But you have voted to, I believe, to raise the minimum wage over a period of years till 2025 to $15 mm-hmm. an hour. And I think Virginia, at least for metropolitan Washington, is the last jurisdiction to do so. And also, you've decriminalized marijuana possession, making mm-hmm. it a fine of $25 for small amounts. And also, you're even considering, I think before the legislature's over this time, there may be a law allowing some casinos, which is a huge change for Virginia.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a lot. I mean, and I'll say this. I think the right to work will be an ongoing discussion. The Senate referred it to be studied for this year, and, you know, we'll talk about we'll talk more about that down the road. But you're right. There were a lot of good bills that have been passed that improve the quality of life for workers and their families. You know, the minimum wage, a bill to prevent wage theft. And the one that's still on the table is allowing for collective bargaining in the public sector. So again, sausage still being made, but I am confident we are going to come out of here, you know, with a great package to move Virginia forward. Another thing, you know, Todd Gilbert stood up on the floor in the beginning and said, "You're moving too slow. You're not going to get your stuff done. You don't know what you're doing," basically. And, you know, the day of crossover, the House of Delegates finished their work at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, which was pretty early. Now he says you're moving too fast. You know, you're doing too many things. And I just say, hey, look, bud, we're making progress.
Tom Shard, for listeners who do not understand, what is crossover?
Crossover, that's the middle of the legislative session where a bill in the House or a bill in the Senate has to pass and be sent over to the other House or it dies.
Here now is John in Fairfax. John, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hi there. I had a question about the gun laws that are being passed. There was a bunch of what would seem like common sense gun laws, like in introducing and increasing mandatory minimums for criminals that use guns within the commission of a crime, that never even made it out of committee. Yet the assault weapons ban that would seek to punish hundreds of thousands of Virginians over magazine capacity and already owned firearms and would actually make it harder for them to continue to keep them by imposing a brand new permit process and potentially taxes. How come the quote-unquote common sense gun laws of actually punishing criminals with the use of firearms didn't even make it out of committee?
Susan Swecker?
You know, I can't speak to each and every bill. I mean, there are a lot of them, but that's again a part of the sausage making piece of this. But I don't even really understand why anybody needs to have an assault weapon in the first place. So I think that's just a common sense
bill.
John,
why do you think you need an assault weapon?
An assault weapon is the so-called description of assault weapons with House Member Levine can be seen on video. It's a misconception about what a firearm is. Most of the features on those firearms are actually just to make them more ergonomic. It helps female shooters. It helps people with disabilities who have trouble shooting firearms. The so-called features on assault weapons actually make it easier for people with disabilities to be able to control their firearms and be able to shoot.
Excuse me, this is Tom Sherwood. One of the issues on getting an assault weapons ban or passed is you have to define what an assault weapon is, but we're talking about multi-round 12, you know, the ability to shoot many rounds quickly. Why would anyone want to do that?
The ability to shoot rounds quickly is the ability to be able to defend your family and defend your home. The Second Amendment doesn't say anything about the right to be able to hunt or be able to do any of those things. It's the right to bear arms to defend yourself and whatever else you need to. Now, the fact
is, part
is
of an organized militia.
Is there any war weapon that you would ban? That you would ban?
The problem with trying to define a weapon is that there are old school weapons such as lever action rifles that will do the same amount of damage. Most mass shootings are not even caused by rifles. If you look up some of the FBI statistics, rifles in, I believe, 2018 only caused 6 deaths in the state of Virginia. Most mass shootings are carried out with handguns, not assault weapons or assault rifles.
Susan Swecker?
The governor and leaders in the House and Senate have made it crystal clear that all these measures are constitutional. They've been held up in other states, and they are designed to keep people safe. Virginians on both sides of the aisle actually support some common sense measures like universal background checks. Now, again, I want to say again, I'm from Highland County. I know what it's like to grow up in a rural community where hunting is a part of the way of life. But these gun measures aren't designed to infringe on the rights of responsible gun owners. They're meant to keep people safe, and that's what we're doing.
Here now is Ralph in Washington, D.C. Ralph, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hi, Kojo. I keep hearing these Democrats, and, you know, we're going to lose the election, and Trump's going to win again. And just get a mirror up and look in the mirror and wonder why. They're sitting there saying they're going to protect us by taking away assault weapons. And like the man said, assault weapons are a very small portion. They took away guns in London, and guess what? They get more murders in London than they do in New York City. You know what they're doing? They're stabbing each other. So now what they want to do is they want to take away pointy knives. And you got to get a permit to buy a pointy knife. You know, you asked why I wanted an assault. I would like to. I don't have a gun. But if I wanted the right to have a gun, Hamilton said he wanted it in there for the right to bear arms because of the government. And what we're seeing from the Democrats are oh, not only do we want to take away the First Amendment, we want to take away the Second Amendment, so we're going to silence you, and then we're going to take away your guns in case you want to say anything.
What, okay, allow me to have Susan Swecker respond, because we don't have a great deal of time.
Yeah, I'm not sure there's, you know, usually when these conversations, there's not a lot of way to respond and really have a constructive conversation. But I will say even conservative Justice Anthony Scalia said that the Second Amendment wasn't finite. It wasn't, you know, you did not have a right to own a gun if you were a danger to others and if you were other things in there, just sort of like, you know, in the First Amendment, you have no right to yell fire in a crowded theater.
Let's talk about something that's going to change, and that's voting, making it easier to vote. Unfortunately, as I saw it, the legislation that's being approved won't take effect until 2022, which I might point out is after the next governor's election in 2021. But there will be same-day registration. There will be easier absentee balloting. I don't think there's any early voting still, but you did make some changes in making it easier for people to vote.
Absolutely. No excuse absentee voting, which is huge. Automatic voter registration. Same-day registration. And, you know, here's the other one. I got to tell you, I love this one. We are eliminating Lee Jackson Day in Virginia, and we're making it a state election day, a state holiday.
What are you going to call it? Just Election Day?
Yeah, I guess so. I guess Election Day is a state holiday, right? And we've repealed the onerous photo ID ban.
Well, you mentioned the part of Virginia that you are from, and it's my understanding that that's not that far away from West Virginia, if one looks at a map.
Does it border?
I do. I border West Virginia on three sides.
In the midst of all this activity, West Virginia Governor Jim Justice decided the time was ripe to remind conservative Virginia counties to consider seceding to his state, a standing offer first made during the Civil War. What do you make of these calls for what some people are calling a vexit?
Well, I saw that he stood there with Jerry Falwell Jr., and I'd say if he wants to move over to Jerry Falwell, I think West Virginia would be a good place for him to go. But but there's a story that and I don't know if it's true or not, but I love to tell it. Back during the run up to the Civil War, that the person from Highland County that was designated to go to the meeting to decide whether or not to secede. Well, he got in the cups a little bit the night before and overslept, and that's why we stayed in the Confederacy and didn't join the Union. But I have no idea if that's true or not. But this is just all crazy silliness and the kind of stuff that doesn't actually move anything forward at all.
We'll have a good party tomorrow night.
Before you go, we got an email from someone who said, would you please ask what the Virginia Democratic Party and nonpartisan groups are doing to increase the number of registered voters in Virginia and what people can do if they want to help? Also, what are the opportunities for the Virginia state government to make registration more automatic, especially for young people, people of color, and people in lower income families, so volunteers don't have to chase people around with clipboards?
Well, they said automatic registration when you're 18.
Yeah, and I'll just add in, and one that just didn't pass this year, but, you know, Senator Marsden had the bill in that would automatically register you to vote at 16 at the DMV, and it did not pass. So maybe that's something y'all can help, these folks writing in can help us get past next year and make it a little easier. But, hey, we got a lot of stuff, good stuff going on that.
Well, you got a primary coming up on March 3rd, and registration in Virginia is nonpartisan. So who can vote in that primary, and what can people do if they're not sure they can vote or where and when to vote?
Okay, so the first thing is it's go to vote at your regular voting place if you want to vote on Election Day. Absentee balloting is open now, so you can request your absentee ballot or go in and vote by absentee. Now, the thing is, in Virginia, we do not identify by party ID. So if you go in, and we're only having a Democratic primary. 4 years ago, we had one on the Democratic side and one on the Republican side. So you just go in and you ask for a Democratic ballot, and you can vote.
There you go. Republicans are doing a convention.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah, they are doing a convention. We find primaries to be more open and inclusive and involve more people, and it's easier. But I would also say to anybody that wanted more information on voting, whether it's the presidential primary or the things that we have done, is just go to vademocrats.org/vote.
And I'm afraid that's all the time we have. We'll be joined shortly by Shebra Eppens, who is president of the Montgomery County Board of Education. Susan Swecker, thank you for joining us.
It's a pleasure. Thank you all for having me.
Okay, thank
you. Susan Swecker is chairwoman of the Democratic Party of Virginia. I'm Kojo Nam. Welcome back. Joining us in studio now is Shebra Evans. She is the president of the Montgomery County Board of Education. Shebra Evans, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
If you have questions or comments about anything that the Montgomery County Board of Education is doing, now is the time to call, whether you have praise or whether you want to attack them. 800-433-8850. You've been on the Montgomery County School Board for 3 years. You are in your second year as a one-year term. As president, your board oversees the biggest school district in the state and the 14th biggest in the nation. So let's get to the issues immediately.
Sure.
Recently, a lot of parents and others have expressed anxiety over a so-called boundary analysis of Montgomery County schools. What is that and why is it causing so much angst?
You know, I'm not for sure. It's just an analysis. That's what I want to let everyone know. We are, as you said, the 14th largest school district. We have 208 schools. We are, since 2010, we have grown by, our student enrollment has increased by more than 25,000 students. In the next 6 years, we expect to increase our student enrollment by another 11,000 students. So we are just trying to take a comprehensive look at our entire district so that we can see how we are utilizing our schools and cluster boundaries. That's part of our fiduciary responsibility.
You've hired a consulting firm.
External
consulting. WXY.
That is correct.
I don't know why they didn't put a Z on it, WXY. But they're due to have another report. They've done a lot of public meetings around the county. But their report later this month, or when are they coming out with their next report or first report?
So the next report, the update, will be coming out later this month, and we will get our final analysis back from them in June of 2020. So we try to do extensive community engagement. We've done over 24
meetings. Well, I noticed in Howard County, there was a boundaries were redrawn. I think it's an issue. Fairfax, in many places, some people are saying that the school districts have resegregated. And that they through various development, and that you need to change the boundaries. Where do boundaries come in? When will you discuss changing boundaries? You know, because people buy homes near schools they want to go to. Some people are left out because of that. Some people fear there's going to be more busing in Montgomery County. Just where is the change of boundaries to put people's mind at ease or get them more excited?
So
where does that fit?
You know what? So in Montgomery County, part of our role on the school board is educational planning of our facilities. So that's something that we do on a regular basis. When our community members, adults, and students have come to our public meetings with WXY, what they have found is that Montgomery County has done over 131 boundaries. We changed boundaries 131 times since the 70s, right? So this is a normal, natural part of what we do. Since the 1970s.
Wow.
Yes. As we build new schools, as we build on additions, we consider boundaries. So we just want to make certain that, as I stated earlier, we are growing by leaps and bounds, and we just want to make certain that we are utilizing our facilities to the best of
ability. Well, let me suggest what might be raising alarms, because apparently one of the projects, the boundary analysis, one of its objectives is analyzing opportunities to create more diverse schools. For a lot of people, that sets off alarms. Also, maximize the number of students that are able to walk to school. For another group of people, that also sets off alarms. I think, do you see that when you talk about creating more diverse schools, can you see that issues of race and class are affecting how people look at this issue?
Well, that's one of the factors. When we are considering boundary analysis, we're looking at four factors. We're looking at geographic proximity. We're looking at the facility utilization. We are looking at diversity around racial, cultural, socioeconomics. And we are also looking at the stability of school assignments. We're looking at all those things. And we are currently undergoing three boundaries right now. We're looking at Westbrook, Somerset. This is the work of the board.
It's an ongoing
issue. And what I will say, this is analysis. The board wants to make certain that as we do future boundaries, that we are doing our due diligence, that we are taking a look at our entire county, so that one of the revisions that we made to the policy was to look at adjacency. You know, what we typically do is we stay within the cluster. Now we're trying to look at adjacent clusters. So there will not be students going from one part of the county to like from Tacoma to Poolsville. That will not be happening. We will be looking at adjacent clusters to see if there's schools that are underutilized. We want to make certain that we are maximizing our facilities to the utmost. I'm a mother. I'm a parent. We do not want our students
two children
to be
in
over.
County
I have two
schools.
Children.
Elementary, junior, seniors?
A middle schooler. Sierra's in the eighth grade, and Sydney is a junior. John F. Kennedy High School and Argyle Middle School.
I want to get to the Kerwin Commission.
Sure.
Before you get there, there are some people who want to talk about the issue that we are currently discussing. So, mm-hmm. Melissa in Clarksburg, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hi, how are you? Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Okay, great. So, Ms. Evans, my question was for you. And on September 14th of 2018, there was a board meeting, and you gave a very heartfelt testimony about the new FAA policy, using the word especially in terms of demographics. You said we need to give the kids what they need where they're at. No matter where they are, we need to provide it. You also said, and I'm quoting, I'm not going to be in favor of adding the word especially when we're to give more weight to that one factor. You also spoke about how sad it was when if you're against this idea, you're automatically labeled racist, like it was all or nothing, and that brought you sadness. Well, the FAA policy was ultimately passed, so demographics is weighed more heavily. And I think the first time you got to test this policy was during the Clarksburg-Seneca Valley Boundary Study. And our very diverse community in Clarksburg stated all the arguments you said back in 2018. What happened to that, Deborah Evans, during all the work sessions and meetings we had about the Boundary Study? Every time our community would bring up real and honest reasons why we wanted our kids to stay close to our homes, there was no response from the board. From the majority of the board, and definitely no support. Many times the board.
You're very deep in the weeds here. I'm trying to see if Shebra Evans can extract something from this very detailed conversation.
So basically, you know, our community was labeled as racist when we didn't want our kids to be bused out of the community. So I was just wondering, I hadn't seen that video, and when I saw it, I'm like, where was that Shebra Evans? We saw eye to eye.
Okay, let me ask Shebra Evans where she was.
So that Shebra Evans is still here. I believe in diversity. I also, so we are currently in pending litigation with the Clarksburg community. But what I will say is that we try to make certain that we maximize walkers in the Clarksburg, Seneca Valley, Northwest boundary change. We increased the number of walkers, and we did not pick an option that would have especially strived to increase diversity. We want to make certain that we include all of our four factors and give it full consideration.
And that's one change that you've suggested. Not only have you grown by 25,000 students, but the diversity of the student population has changed a lot. But I want to get to the Kerwin Commission. It's been ongoing for 3 years about how to fund schools on Monday. Mm-hmm. I think it's a holiday, but still on Monday.
Yes,
there is a huge public forum at the state legislature to discuss how the Kerwin Commission will affect statewide funding and county funding. Are you prepared for is the county prepared to put in a lot more money on education under the Kerwin reform? You'll get more money from the state, but the county itself will have to spend more money. Are you ready for that?
So first of all, I thank the caller for calling in. I appreciate her call. And then to you, I will say I will be there on Monday to give testimony. We are in support. We are in full support of the Kerwin recommendations. We want to fund the promise. We have 166,000 plus students here in Montgomery County, and that the funding is very much needed to make certain that we can continue to give our students access. In the Kerwin Commission, we are appreciative of the additional funds that we will receive around pre-K. Right? We want to make certain that our earliest learners have that access to education to level the playing field. There's recommendations around teachers increasing
right.
their
no
pay.
There's no funding at this point.
Yeah, I know they are.
The legislature, the leaders have said we're for it and we're going to fund it. I think Mr. Ferguson, the state Senate president, said there won't be a bunch of new taxes, but somewhere. The money's got to come from somewhere, and it can't just be casinos.
So you are correct. I was just in Annapolis yesterday. The Maryland Association of Boards of Education held their legislative reception, and we heard from various delegates and senators talking about the current commission, the importance of the funding, and that it is inexpensive. It's a heavy lift.
Did you get any solutions on where the money's going to come
from?
We
didn't get any solutions on where the money's going to come from, but we got promises that people were going to work really hard to make certain that we found the funding because we needed it for our students. And so,
and you have approved a budget of $2.8 billion. The council has yet to approve it. We'll see what happens there. But you recently expressed dismay over County Executive Mark Eldridge's capital budget recommendations for Montgomery County Public Schools. Why were you disappointed?
You know what? The whatever we bring forward, we believe that that's what we need in order to be able to provide a quality education for our students. We have experienced growth, so a good bit of the increase in our budget is $2.8 billion, like you said. We've experienced an increase of student enrollment, so a good bit of that is going to the additional students that we have in our school system, as well as trying to expand on eliminate the disparities that we've seen in education. We are expanding pre-K. We have increased our full-day pre-K program in Montgomery County by 1,000 students. We've opened up two pre-K early childhood.
Excuse me, that's a lot of things. How much has Mr. Eldridge? How much money did he not put in that you think
he
should?
That's the capital budget. For the operating budget, the $2.8 billion is the operating budget. So he has not made his, he will come out on March the 15th with his budget, as well as the county council will need to fund our budget. So we have put forth a budget that will continue to expand on access and opportunity for our students around our speakers of other languages.
But you feel you need more in the capital budget.
Well, absolutely. We need more in the capital budget.
We need more everywhere.
We do. We need more everywhere.
Have you cut? You know, one of the critics of school systems said to me, where have school systems cut funding? And it's always a question of increasing, how much we're going to increase. Has there been anything cut in the school system where you said, well, we don't need to do this anymore, we don't need to do that anymore? Just people who complain.
No.
The school budgets always go up. There's never any
side.
Right.
Is there? I mean, maybe that's unrealistic and maybe that's ignorant criticism. But I hear that from people who say, when have the school systems ever cut funding?
So this is what I will say. You know, we have a tough job. Right. And we try to do our best to educate the community on the work of the board. We try to make certain that if there are programs in place that are duplicative, we will cut that. Right. We try to make certain that our focus is not on cutting people. We need our teachers in the room. As a matter of fact, we want to diversify our teaching workforce. We can use more male educators of color. We want
across the board in
elementary, middle, and high school. Absolutely. You hear our students say that they may have had one or two teachers of color. So we want our students.
This is coming from an all-female school board.
Well, we have a student. We have a male student board member.
Well,
a
couple of things about that board, and one of them is how much money you make. Mm-hmm. There has now been a study that suggests that instead of what you currently make on the board, that school board members, instead of making what I think is
25 for the president,
that they should be making $60,000 and the president $70,000. Do you approve of that?
I do. We have a full-time job. It's a full-time, part-time job. Currently, that amount is not being considered. It's $30,000 and then an increase of $35,000 is still out. But we want to be able to attract people from diverse backgrounds with diverse perspectives. $25,000 is not a livable wage. It is not a livable wage. And we want to attract the best and the brightest. Just like we want people to have to be the best and brightest in front of our students, we want those same people in the seats to serve on the board.
Campbell Ryder tweets, over time, MCPS has shown almost no progress in breaking the achievement gap. Latinx performance on Algebra 1 has dropped for the last 3 years. Black performance is back to 2015 lows. Is that correct? And if it is, what do you do about that?
Repeat the question. I'm sorry.
Latinx performance on Algebra 1 has dropped for the past 3 years, and black performance is back to 2015 lows, that you're not, in fact, helping to break the achievement gap.
So we are. We are doing a lot of work around closing the gap, increasing access and opportunity. What we have said on the board, as well as our superintendent, we are not afraid to say that we can do better, that we, what we've done recently is we have shown our data. We've disaggregated in a way that not many do. We are not only looking at it by race, but we're looking at it as by socioeconomic status. And we are closing the gap. We are expanding our dual immersion programs. We have 5 schools that are dual immersion. We are allowing our students to get an associate's degree. We have a partnership with Montgomery College, so our students are graduating with an AA. We are doing universal screening, where we are allowing more students, in particular students in Title I schools, to get access to gifted and enriched
programs.
Allow
me to interrupt, because we're down to about 2 minutes. Your board recently and unanimously approved a 4-year contract for Superintendent Jack Smith, who's led the system since 2016, but not everyone loves Jack Smith, though. Here's Jenna, who lives in Potomac. Jenna, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hi, Shabra.
Hi, Jenna.
Leadership, there have been a lot of resignations recently, right? We've lost the COO, the chief academic officer, the CFO, and general counsel. Typically speaking, when there's that much turnover in leadership, it's signs that there's something else going on. And I'm wondering if you have any concerns about this very high turnover rate of the leaders within the organization.
I don't. I know all the people. None of the resignations are associated with one another. So going back to Dr. Smith, you mentioned
Coach. Not everyone loves Jack.
Yeah, you mentioned not everybody.
The head of the Montgomery County Education Association, that's the union that represents teachers, counselors, others, said that Smith has offered the schools no coherent plan to move the system forward.
And he makes $290,000. What would be the new amount that you proposed?
So we are still, on Monday, we did a tentative adoption. We are still working through contract terms. And so by the end of the month, we will have that finalized. You know what? I have not been a board member on another board, but I have worked with Jack Smith since my election in 2016. You know, you will not find a more humble, down-to-earth gentleman. He has, he comes from the state. He served as an interim state superintendent. He has a wealth of knowledge, and he is trying to bring the system forward. What he does really well is when we are looking at the data, he's using a flashlight. It's not a hammer. He's being courageous at saying, you know what, we have not done well for all of our students, and here's what we're going to do going forward.
Gotta go. Will you run again?
She's running
absolutely
now.
Absolutely. I'm running for re-election.
She's got two opponents.
I do. I have a primary April 28th, and I'm very excited. You know, we have so much more that we want to do. And under Jack Smith's leadership, I believe that we will get that done. We are closing.
Shebra Evans is the president of the Montgomery County Board of Education. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Today's show was produced by Lauren Marco. Our next Coder in Your Community is just over a week away, and we'll be discussing how immigration policies are affecting local families. It's on February 25th at the Columbia Heights Educational Campus. Learn how to get tickets and more at kojoshow.org. Coming up Monday, Virginia is a top destination for libel tourism. We'll hear about efforts to crack down on slap lawsuits, and author Jason Reynolds on his new role as the National Ambassador for Young People's Literature. That all starts at noon on Monday. Then, what will you be doing, Charlotte?
Going to check into that March 3rd Virginia presidential primary. There's some places in Virginia I want to go and talk to people.
Have a wonderful weekend. I'm Kojo Nandi.
The Kojo Nandi Show is produced by Julie Deppenbrock, Sydney Grannon, Lauren Marco, and Victoria Chamberlain. Our managing producer is Mana Kashvi. Our engineer is Ben Privet. Our intern is Richard Cunningham. For past shows and more content, visit kojoshow.org.
WAMU 88.5 is your listener-supported NPR news station in the greater Washington, D.C. region. You can support the Kojo Namdi Show and all the regional coverage you value by becoming a member today. Click the donate button at WAMU.org, and thanks.